Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started with our first judiciary meeting for the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is for our first meeting for the 2015 session. I want to thank everyone for being here. Today is kind of an opening day, and it's going to be more of kind of organizational and informational type of stuff. We will have a couple of public hearings and possible work sessions toward the end after we have our informational meeting. So with that, I'm going to first ask us going into, I guess we need to go ahead and do the organizational meeting. Let's go ahead and go with the adoption of the rules. So we'll go into work session for the purpose of adoption of our committee rules.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2015.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2015. Is there any discussion? All right, let me just ask counsel. I am assuming these are the uniform rules that the committees throughout the Senate will be using and pretty much modeled after what we've seen in previous years.
Chair Plonsky, members of the committee, that is correct, with the one exception that in 2013 we did not have a particular amendment requirement, but we did have it in 2014. So as you may recall, amendments now must be posted on OLIS 1 hour before they can be worked.
All right, and I think there's also one other issue. I don't know if it's captured in the rules or not, but there's an interpretation that when a amendment is actually brought before the committee through staff in the sense of that you're going to have it filed, it will also become public in the sense of that there's a requirement that when you go for fiscals, that at that point it would be available to the general public, not just internal.
And I'm assuming, Mr. Chair, that it will be on OLIS, but committee members will still get paper copies of the amendments. Because for some of us dinosaurs, if we're working something, it's nice to have it on. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm with you. All righty. So with that, any other discussion? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, the rules are adopted. And at this point, let's see, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session and go back to our organizational meeting. And what I said before we came on to the system for recording, I was going to ask each of the members to please introduce themselves and tell a little bit about where you're from and anything else you might want to share. I think what we're going to do is we'll start with my former chair of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Jenny Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jenny Burdick. I represent Senate District 18, which is parts of Southwest and Northwest Portland and Tigard, the entire city of Tigard. This is a return home for me. I'm delighted to be back. I served on Judiciary from the 1999 session through the 2007 session. See a lot of familiar faces out there. I'm delighted to be back.
Well, thank you very much. Let's go ahead. I'm kind of going back and forth on this, so let's go ahead. Senator Kim Thatcher.
I'm Kim Thatcher. I represent District 13, and that includes, I got to get this down because it's a lot more than what I used to have. Kaiser, St. Paul, Newburgh, of course, but then also goes up into Wilsonville and Sherwood and outlying areas of Beaverton, Alloa, Tigard, and King City, and I might be missing a couple there, but unincorporated areas of Washington County and Clackamas County. And I was in the House up until this, January 12th, and I served on the Judiciary Committee during my first session, and I enjoyed it immensely.
Wonderful.
Happy to be back.
Well, thank you. Glad that you're here. So we're going to also now hear from Senator Sarah Gelster.
So my name is Sarah Gelster, and I represent Senate District 8, which is Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, Millersburg, Tangent, and unincorporated areas of Lynn and Benton County. I've been in the House since 2005, so I'm also new to the Senate. I've never served on the Judiciary Committee, but have always wanted to, so I'm looking forward to the challenge and the workload here.
All right, wonderful. And my vice chair, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. I'm Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is Southwest Oregon. I have been on this committee for
ever. I
think. Chair Brzezinski, you and I are the only continuous members for a long time here. I enjoy this committee a lot. We have done a lot of good things together, and we have disagreed on a lot of things, which is absolutely the way this is supposed to go. But as the Senate President will point out to virtually anybody, in his opinion, this is the most important committee in the building, and all bills should go through Judiciary. I don't necessarily agree with that, but when I look at the interim work we've been doing, we have some pretty significant items on our agenda for this committee, and I look forward to doing some very positive things.
Wonderful, thank you. So I'm Senator Floyd Brzezinski. I have the opportunity to continue to chair Senate Judiciary Committee, and I really honor that opportunity and the privilege that it has given to me. I serve for Senate District 4, includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. And my day job, I serve as a prosecutor under contract with cities that have municipal ordinances. And let's see. I want to first thank the two newest members that we have in the Senate for them being willing to be on Judiciary. So Senator Thatcher and Senator Gelser, thank you all very much. Our plan is pretty straightforward as to what we're going to be doing. We have 123 bills currently. We've gone through, and I'm going to have my vice chair go through a list to give a ranking so we can kind of see where we're at as we move forward on our scheduling of bills for the session for hearings. We will be meeting 4 days a week, and during these 4 days a week at this point, we do have the opportunity, and we may need to use that opportunity as we get closer toward the end of the session to actually go into fifth day. And but my goal is to try to keep the committee meetings concise. You'll notice that even though we have a scheduled time of 8 to 10 for this slot for our committees, normally we will start meeting at 8:30 with some variations depending on, like today, we're starting at 8:45 because we didn't think we needed to take the full time. I found that it's easier to allow people who are commuting in to get here instead of starting right at 8 and then giving you a break afterwards, so we'll do it on the front end. I will be asking each of the members to sit down with me and discuss what your goals are as being a member of the Judiciary Committee and expectations, and we will hopefully be able to do as we have in the past, as Senator Cruz has said, and be very productive in the work that we have for the citizens of Oregon. I know there's a lot more I probably should be saying, but we'll go ahead and stop with that. I'm going to ask Council Chana, if you'll be so kind to introduce yourself. And then after that, I know that we have our various council members and assistants, and if you could please go through introductions for them.
Certainly, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Chana Newell. I have been in the legislature since 2011, working for committee services. I'm a 2010 grad at the University of Oregon School of Law, an undergraduate degree from Oregon State. Our council that we have with us this session, we have Eric Dietrich, who comes to us from the Multnomah Defender's Office.
Great.
Jeff Rhodes from the Multnomah County DA's Office. And Laura Hansel, who has been working as a legislative attorney in animal law. Over here we have Christy Arrington. She was in Judiciary in 2011. She will be with us on and off working both committees. Corey Rosenberg is our new assistant here today. We also have Jenny Donovan, who some of you may know. She is also going to be working on the
same side. Wonderful. So thanks for everyone. As we've seen, and Senator Cruz and I have, I think, have tried to demonstrate, this is a committee that's a team. And without all of your assistance, we would not be able to do our work. And we really, really appreciate your the opportunities you're taking. In many cases, you're putting your professional career or what has been your professional career on hold to be part of this wonderful process and opportunity to serve the people of this state. So with that, is there anything else we need to cover on the organizational part? All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and close the organizational meeting portion of today's hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up an informational hearing. This is going to be an overview on the Oregon courts, and we have the Honorable Thomas A. Ballmer, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Justice Ballmer, please come forward and bring whoever else you'd like with you, including Phil.
I'll bring him no matter what. Chair Brzezinski, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and talk to the committee. I don't think we've done this before, at least not since I've been chief. We have many representatives that appear before this committee on one bill or another, and I'll talk a little bit about how we work over here and how we work in the legislature. But we give our most detailed presentation to Ways and Means, and I'm delighted to be able to give sort of a quick overview of the courts here. We've worked with your three senior members in depth over many sessions, and it's great to have the two newer members on the committee. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. Phil Lemon is, I was trying to think what his title is, but he's sort of our, we're very thinly staffed over at the court. So he's our public information officer, our legislative liaison, our outreach coordinator, and I'm not sure what else.
Other duties as assigned.
Other duties as assigned, and you will see Phil over in the building a lot. He sort of manages our tracking of the legislation. And even though we don't have very many bills, substantive bills ourselves, that we come over here and ask you to enact on our behalf, we are involved with a lot of legislation because so much. As my presentation will show, goes through the courts.
And Justice Ballmer, yes. I know that there are two individuals that work over at Judicial Department that will be having interface with us. I wonder if you'd be so kind to introduce Josh and Bruce.
Yes, Bruce Miller and Josh Nasby are here, and they will be working with you on a regular basis. Bruce also coordinates our detailed review of the legislation. He's the one to whom we refer all the bills that come in that have a fiscal, might affect the courts, and he sort of reaches out to others within the judicial branch, whether they're judges or staff folks, either within Salem or around the state, and pulls together the information that we can then give to this committee or to other committees in the legislature. So Bruce and Josh, you'll see a lot also.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think it's always good to put a name and a face, and with having two new members, so they understand who might potentially.
Right. Thank you for reminding me about that, Senator.
You're a rookie, so you know it's.
These guys have a lot of experience. So thank you, Chair Brzezinski. I'm just going to go over this very quickly. There's one of the things that we see in the legislature, particularly when we have new members, is some people have not spent a lot of time with the courts. Others are very sophisticated and have a very in-depth knowledge of what courts do, what the Oregon courts do. And so I'm going to hit some things starting at the beginning. You'll see it's pretty basic. But we'll go through this pretty quickly, and feel free to stop me, Chair Brzezinski, or any other members of the committee, and ask a question at any time. I'm going to talk a little bit about what the courts do, and then talk about how OJD, the Oregon Judicial Department, will appear before you during this session, either individual judges or Bruce or Josh or Phil or others. And then I'm going to review at the end very quickly a presentation that we made to a few of you during the legislative trainings last month. The basics you all know, three branches of government. And in the Oregon Constitution, which was written in 1857, these are all referred to as departments. There's the legislative department and the executive department and the judicial department. And by a constitutional amendment of about 4 years ago, these were all renamed branches. So now we are the judicial branch, you're the legislative branch. And the legislative branch consists really of three things. By far the largest is what in statute is still referred to as the judicial department. That's the state courts, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the circuit courts. The Office of Public Defense Services is also included for organizational purposes within the judicial branch. Those are the folks, it's a commission that the legislature established that supervises and does the funding of indigent defense services, and that's criminal cases. And they are in charge of a very large chunk of change that provides counsel for folks who are charged with crimes, who can't afford their own lawyers. And then there is, third, the Judicial Fitness and Disability Commission. That's a special ethics commission for the courts, and they apply the Code of Judicial Conduct, which is the set of rules, the set of ethical rules that judges live by. So the courts resolve all kinds of disputes, criminal, civil, family law, many others, and we act as a check and balance with the other branches of the legislature. And we ask whether when the governor, when the executive branch acts or when the legislature acts, are they acting within the limits of their constitutional or statutory authority? When the police searched the house and found drugs, did they have a warrant? Or was the search reasonable? That's the sort of question that comes to the courts again and again. When the legislature passed a law saying or limiting the amount of their own money that candidates could spend on an election, did that violate constitutional free speech rights? So we adjudicate cases when they come to us about legislative actions and about executive actions. So the sure, yeah, go ahead.
But for both of those, unless somebody asks you the question, you can't do anything.
That is a really good point. One of the this is something we don't think about very much. We can't self-start. The legislature self-starts. You see a policy problem, you can work on a solution. Maybe it won't get enacted, but you can work on it. We can't go out and say, oh, there's a law, maybe that's unconstitutional. We wait until a case is brought before us, and we can only decide legal questions. Is this statute constitutional? How should it be applied? Exactly what does it mean in the context of a specific case? There are some state Supreme Courts around the country, mostly on the East Coast, it's an old tradition in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, that judges can issue advisory opinions. And the legislature may direct to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts a question, is this law that we're thinking about passing constitutional? And the legislature will give them the Supreme Court will give them an answer. And our tradition and our Constitution say, no, we decide cases. That's the way we exercise our judicial power. So the purpose of the judicial branch is to administer justice in a fair and timely way. And our Constitution, written in 1857, adopted by the voters in 1857, and then it became effective in 1859 when we became a state, says that justice is to be administered openly and without delay. And that's really a directive to the legislature. We have to have a court system, and to the courts, this is the way you have to administer justice. So our goals are to ensure justice for all Oregonians. That's our constitutional directive. We want to administer our cases effectively and timely. We want to be as cost efficient as we can be. We exist here to resolve disputes, but we also build partnerships with state and local law enforcement, with the defense community, with all of those who use the courts. And we need to maintain public trust and confidence. Not every violation of the law has to go to court. We want people to follow the law themselves. One of the reasons that our country works in a lot of ways is that, for example, on the economic side, we know that if we don't pay our debts, somebody's can sue us and enforce that in court. And for that reason, and because it's a sort of a moral obligation, people do pay the money that they're owed. We don't have to have courts to force people to obey the law. People will obey the law, but having the courts there to say, if you don't and you're prosecuted, you'll be punished as the law permits, helps ensure that people do conform their behavior to our criminal laws, the rules that we've agreed to as a society. So meeting these goals requires adequate access to justice. Access to justice is sort of a way of talking about how we provide an open court system and how people can get into court. I know this is not the Ways and Means Committee, and I'm not going to give my budget plea unless you want to hear it at some other time. But OJD is less than 3% of the general fund. We do have, it's actually our operational dollars are smaller than the dollars that you see in the budget because we pass things through. There's some funding for legal aid that comes through the courts and then out to legal aid, for mediation services, for court facilities, which by statute are really the county's obligation. The counties are supposed to provide adequate court facilities and security, but counties, as you know, are often strapped for cash. The legislature has appropriately, I think, helped out counties in some respects with security, and then now, and we can talk about this later, some construction funding to replace unsafe courthouses. So there's certainly some monies that come through the judicial branch that just go out. Most of our budget is for trial court operations. We operate, and I'll show you a slide in a minute with a map. We have 44 courthouse facilities. We have facilities in each of the 36 counties. We operate through 27 judicial districts. We are across the state, and that's where most of our dollars go. We have a relatively modest central staff in Salem, where we provide central services, our IT support, human resources, the normal sorts of activities that any large organization needs, and we provide a lot of that centrally in Salem. We sort of fund ourselves. Senator Whitsitt likes to point out to his colleagues on Ways and Means, and we always appreciate it, how much of our budget we bring ourselves. We bring in $227 million in fines and fees, or we did in 2011-13. Most of this comes into the general fund. We don't get to keep it. Some of it goes into a criminal fines account, and we get some of that. And then we've also collected an average in the past few years of $20 million for crime victims. Again, just very briefly, the budget priorities. We were very pleased with the co-chair's proposed framework because that at least gives us our current service level, which we need to stay open. We took a big hit, like a lot of other state agencies did, during the recession. We cut 17% of our staff. And we were closed on certain Fridays over a 3 to 4 year period. With the 2013 legislature, we were brought back up to a funding level that allowed us to remain open every business day, which is really what we need to do. You know, if somebody needs a restraining order against an abusive ex-boyfriend on Friday, being threatened, worried about contact over the weekend, telling this person you can come in on Monday is not very helpful. We need to be open every day. When Nike has three employees leaving for Adidas, taking the designs they've been working on for the past year, they file that in state court. And I think they filed that one on a Friday. And the courts need to be open so people can get access to the courts. That's an access to justice issue. So we were delighted to see our current service level budget in the co-chair's framework. E-court is something I could give a 2 or 3 day seminar on. I won't. If you have specific questions, for those who are newer, we are in the middle of a multi-year project moving our courts to an electronic case management system with electronic filing, document access over the internet. This is a state tech project that is working. We are more than halfway there. We went live with Multnomah County, which is our biggest court, in May, and then with Marion and two other courts in December. And we have a schedule whereby this project will be completed at the end of June 2016. So we need continued funding for that. We're getting bond funding for the implementation, and I am confident we'll get those funds because the project is working well. Doesn't mean it's not difficult. Doesn't mean that there aren't some flies in the ointment, but that in general, it's working pretty well. We need appropriate judicial compensation. I won't talk about that now, but that is an issue. We need safe and suitable court facilities, including replacing some courthouses around the state. And the legislature has been very thoughtful and helpful about that recently. We need to improve trial court services. That's where we cut, because that's the biggest part of our budget. When we had to lay off these 17% of the people, the people we lost were the family law coordinators in the trial courts who help self-represented people who are trying to get a divorce, trying to work out custody disputes in order to dissolve a marriage that wasn't working. interpreters, folks who can do mediation and try and solve some of these small family or small claims disputes without having a judge say, yes, it's black or white. Maybe it's better in many circumstances, not all, to try and mediate a solution that that both people can go along with. And help families access justice. As you know, in this state, unfortunately, we have a lot of families that are stressed. We have parents who are unwilling or unable to take care of their kids. DHS steps in. All of those things require court involvement. And that is one of the most important things that we do. And then funding treatment courts, which I'll talk about in a minute. Let me talk just a second about OJD at the legislature, because as Chair Przanski said, we have individuals over here. We have individuals from central staff like Bruce and Josh and Phil. But we also, you will also see judges, and you will see staff members from around the state here. What we ask of these folks is that they tell you who they're representing. If a legislator comes and sits here and talks about a bill, you don't assume that they're speaking for the entire legislative branch. And unless they're authorized, if a judge is over here talking about how they feel about a particular bill, don't assume that they're speaking for the entire judicial branch. And I've asked our judges and staff members to be clear who they're representing. They may come, if you have the presiding judge, Chair Przanski, and you're in Lane County or Douglas, Randy Garrison comes up and you ask him to talk about how a particular procedure is working in his court, that's great. We want that to happen. Our judges have in-depth knowledge of how a lot of the statutes that you've written and that you're going to, things you're going to be thinking about as you consider various policy issues in connection with the bills that are before you. We would like them to be able to be here, but we don't take positions on very many substantive bills. As a branch. That's your job, in our view. You set the policy, we decide the cases, we try and interpret the statutes that you enact, but we do have a few mostly judicial administration kinds of bills that that we have introduced and that we hope you'll look favorably on. Many, many more bills have implications for the courts, and we'll be over here in an information-providing capacity giving a fiscal of some kind. But in general, we have a limited policy agenda that relates primarily to court administration. We do require resources from the legislature. I've just touched upon these already, and I'm not going to spend much time with this slide. It's not just the criminal laws. It's enforcing the rules of the marketplace. We had at our Ways and Means Committee at the last legislative session, a representative from Nike came and testified in support of our budget. And he said, look, sometimes we win, sometimes we lose. That's not the issue. The fact is we need a well-functioning court system. We need judges who have an understanding of the civil law. You need to pay the judges enough so we can attract some good people who have civil law experience. But it is very important to us, whether it's disputes with our customers, with our employees, or others, to have a well-functioning court system. And we do establish debts. We establish property rights. We apply the laws as they're enacted by the legislature. We don't make policy choices on those things. But the fact that we do have a well-functioning court system is very important to economic development in this state. We also foster public safety, not just through enforcing the criminal laws, but through restraining orders and through intervention in families if a child has been abused or neglected or is threatened in some way. And we also are spending an increasing amount of our time dealing with the elderly folks. These are very difficult issues. It's one thing to say, well, let's have a guardian for somebody who's under 18. It's very difficult to decide when someone who's 85 and has been an independent, fully functioning, smart, engaged adult, and now some people are saying, well, they really can't take care of themselves anymore. We had a session on this last week at a judicial education meeting, and they're very difficult issues, and we're going to see them increasingly with our aging population. We have a slide that sort of shows what I'm talking about, and what we say is courts are at the core. And what we're showing is all the between the issues we have in our society, whether it's crimes and violence, kids at risk, economic disputes, and domestic relations, to get to the results we want, which is punishing people for violating the criminal law, getting them rehabilitated, moving them or moving kids out of the house, getting the judgments that will allow businesses and individuals to assert their economic rights, protecting the environment, all these things have to go through the courts. So in some ways, we're the branch that nobody knows. If you go through the paper, take the paper, go through and see how many of the stories relate to things that are in court. But you don't see it as a court story. You see it as a, oh gosh, here's another kid who's been abused at home. That's what the story is. Well, it's there because there was a court action involved. Or, you know, here's a dispute between Nike and Adidas. Or here is a land use dispute between, you know, involving the urban growth boundary. Maybe that's not a good example. You know, here's a dispute between, we have a tax dispute right now, but with, you know, various big telecom providers and the state. All these things end up in court. Very quickly, the, let's go on to this slide. Here's the way we're set up in Oregon, and most of you know this, so I'm just going to go very briefly. We have a Supreme Court of seven justices. We choose our own chief. I'm the Chief Justice. I'm chosen by my colleagues. We have a Court of Appeals of 13 judges. They sit in panels of three. And then we have our trial courts, our courts of general jurisdiction, our circuit courts. We have 173 judges in 27 judicial districts. We have almost 200 independently elected judges and about 1,800 FTE positions. And then we have a tax court that hears all sorts of tax disputes. They come directly to the Supreme Court. I might pause here just to remind folks that judges in Oregon are elected. We are nonpartisan. We serve six-year terms. If someone retires before the end of their term, the governor appoints a replacement, and that person has to run at the next general election. We have been fortunate to avoid some of the nasty multi-million dollar campaigns and judicial elections that we've seen in some other states, and we hope to continue that. But that is, I know that's an issue that's being discussed, you know, by some people in the building. But this is the setup of the state court system now. There is also, under the Constitution, as Chair Prozanski mentioned, there are municipal courts and justice courts are permitted under the Constitution. They are controlled by legislation as to their jurisdiction and what happens in what kinds of cases they can handle. But we have no control over them. That is those are municipal, county, and city-run operations. The state court system is the one that's outlined here. So the Supreme Court, we have discretionary review of Court of Appeals decisions. This is like the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, people will say, well, we're taking this case to the U.S. Supreme Court. They get 10,000, 15,000 petitions a year, and they take, you know, 80 of them. We get about 1,000 petitions a year from decisions of the Court of Appeals. People didn't like what happened to them in the Court of Appeals, and the lawyers bring the case to us. We allow 6 or 7% of those. A lot of these are routine criminal cases. We're not, you know, the Court of Appeals decision was fine. Maybe the Court of Appeals didn't even write an opinion, but those are easy denies. There are other issues that involve major new statutes, constitutional provisions that, you know, the free expression or, you know, gun rights under the Oregon Constitution. People bring those cases, and if it's a difficult issue, we'll decide a case after it's gone through the Court of Appeals. The legislature has sent certain cases directly to the Supreme Court without going through the Court of Appeals, like death penalty cases, tax court, attorney discipline, our favorite, ballot titles, Prison siting disputes and a sort of a bizarre group of other decisions of the Energy Facilities Siting Council come directly to the Supreme Court. Who knew? And then we have permissive review. These are writs that are ancient. You can tell from the Latin names, but they still exist, and we still have jurisdiction to decide those. So a prisoner, if they've been unable to get relief anywhere else and they say, I'm being wrongly imprisoned here, no, I was never charged, they can still come to the Supreme Court with a habeas corpus petition, just like the internees in Guantanamo, and we can consider that case. Now, usually they should have gone somewhere else, or they are being properly held, they just don't like being held, but we can hear those kinds of cases. The Oregon Supreme Court has the final word. We're the last word on the Oregon Constitution and Oregon statutes. We try our best to get it right. If we don't on statutes, you can tell us. But we are the end of the road for almost all of these cases. If something raises a United States federal statute or statutory or constitutional question, someone can ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review our decision, and people routinely do, for example, in death penalty cases, and there are some others. But the U.S. Supreme Court rarely takes cases coming out of Oregon, and even then, they will defer to our interpretation of the state statute and the state constitution, unless it directly conflicts with a federal law. And if it directly conflicted with a federal law, we would have figured that out, because we have to apply federal statutory and constitutional provisions anyhow. And we'll do that. So the Court of Appeals, they hear all the appeals, criminal, civil, domestic relations, juvenile. If there's an appeal of an agency rule, the Department of Environmental Quality or the Environmental Quality Commission issues some rules and people say, no, you didn't have the authority to do that, those go to the Court of Appeals first and then to us. They don't go to the circuit court, the general trial court. Appeals from state agency actions, whether it's LUBA or the Employment Relations Board, or the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, all these things go up to the Court of Appeals. And then the Tax Court, as I mentioned, has a jurisdiction over state tax issues. The circuit courts, in some states, for those of you who may have had experience in other states, this may be called a superior court. In New York, confusingly, this is called the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is called the Court of Appeals. But unless you're practicing in New York, we don't have to worry too much about that. Our circuit courts are our courts of general jurisdiction. And they are courts of record. That means that there is a record of every case. We no longer have court reporters. You think back to Perry Mason, or think back to when, if any of you were in court, 20 years ago, there were a lot of court reporters. We don't do that anymore. Where everything is recorded on tape. It's not even tape anymore. It's some disc. It's some sort of hard medium. And then they're transcribed if there is an appeal. So they're courts of record, they cover everything. And I don't want to go through the kinds of cases that I've mentioned before, but virtually everything under the sun can come to the courts one way or another. And Senator Cruz mentioned the fact that we can't decide cases if in the abstract. We have to have an actual case behind us. The flip side of that is, and I would say the legislature doesn't have this burden, we have to decide the case. We can't say this issue is too hard, let's wait till next session. We decide the case as it comes to us because that somebody has to do it. And as I say, we decide the best we can. One of the things that shocked me when I came to the court, I thought, oh, well, we'll figure out the right answer. Well, sometimes there's not a right answer. There's a 65% answer, and then there's a 35% answer. But since we have to make a decision, we go with the 65% answer or the 55% answer. It's not always easy. The judicial districts, this is just a little map. Showing our 27 judicial districts. As you'll see, most of them are one county, but a fair number of them in less populated counties we have combined, so we've got two or three or four courts together in one judicial district, and the judges or judge, we have a number of districts that have just one judge, will go to the different county seats on a regular basis. And so each of your legislative districts represents more than one county and more than one judicial district. So if you want to be in touch or get information from the judges or court staff in your area, you can do that directly, obviously, or let us know, and we'd be happy to put you in touch with those folks or have them come visit with you. Every judicial district has a presiding judge. In the judicial districts where there's only one, that person is the presiding judge. Greg Baxter out in Baker City, he's it. And each one also has a trial court administrator, or TCA, who is the primary staff person there. And we work closely with those people. That's our real governance structure, our group of 27 presiding judges and 27 trial court administrators. Caseload, we had more than 500,000 cases last year. Now, those aren't all big cases. Some of them are very little cases. That includes violations, some traffic violations, hunting and fishing violations. 1,500 cases are filed in the Oregon courts every day. That number has not changed an awful lot. The number tends to fluctuate some with the economy. What has happened, though, in recent years is the cases have gotten more complex. We tend to have more complicated felony cases where there's a substantial prison term awaiting the defendant if he or she is convicted, and the civil cases too. You know, it's not just the straightforward, you stop making your car payments sort of case. A lot of these, for example, in the mortgage foreclosure area, you'd think these would be straightforward cases. Well, not after the mortgages have been packaged and sold as collateralized debt obligations, and we're unsure whether the entity that has filed the case really has the authority to do that. And then the homeowner says, well, they promised me that we'd be able to renegotiate this. All of a sudden, you've got a lot of disputes in addition to this person stopped paying their mortgage. So we've seen more complexity, and that has driven our workload to some extent. And I'm not going to describe this slide in detail, but it just sort of shows you the comparison of our workload, which is our number of cases, which is the gray bar, and the amount of time we have to spend on it. So if you look at the far right, violations, you'll see that is a large percentage of our cases, almost 40%. But the gold bar is the judicial time spent. It does not take much judicial time to deal with these. A lot of these, you know, if I get a speeding ticket, I pay the speeding ticket. I'm not going to deal with it, especially because I'm a judge. I feel like I should pay. But even if I had a good defense. But there are other cases that, if you look at the other the criminal cases, are, you know, maybe 15% of our docket, or 18%, but they require a lot more. Again, look at the gold bar, judicial time, and similarly the general civil probate, and so on. And my point is just that you can look at the large number of cases, and I don't want to sort of say, oh yeah, gosh, look, we've got 500,000 really complicated cases. We don't. We have about 300,000 or 200,000 cases that are really important to somebody. They may not be important in the big scheme of things, but our constitutional promise to the public is that we're going to have a court system where even if it is, you know, a fender bender or being sued on for not paying your credit card debt, or you think you've been treated unfairly by your neighbor or the police or somebody else is not obeying the law as they should, that you have an opportunity to come into court and have that case resolved. That's what we spend the money on, the staff and judges, to help us resolve these disputes as we're required to under the Oregon Constitution. I'm running out of time here, and I don't want to sort of mess up the rest of your agenda, but let me just go through these slides very quickly. We've been doing some things to try and improve access. E-court is putting everything online. Whether it's a good thing for lawyers that 5 o'clock is not the deadline, that you can actually file at 11:59, you can talk to the lawyer's spouse about whether that's a good thing or not. But it is that is the way the world works these days. People can bank 24 hours a day. They can buy from Amazon 24 hours a day. And with eCourt now, they can file their cases 24 hours a day. And they can get access to their documents online, to the court documents online, 24 hours a day. We're now doing online payments. We're getting a lot of the payments that are made into court instead of somebody showing up and, you know, running their credit card right at the window or writing a check there. They can just pay online the way you would for so many other things. And we are now in the process of rolling out intelligent forms, which are forms that help self-represented people do it correctly. That's a help for the person. So suppose you want to get a restraining order against an abusive ex-spouse or boyfriend. We have a form that you can answer a series of questions, and it will produce the petition the way it needs to be in order to get it filed. So we're rolling those out, and it's turning out to be a great savings for the court and for the other folks who come into court, the self-represented litigants. I'm going to move on to just one other thing. Let me just highlight the docket management, which is something that we met on. I met with the presiding judges and the trial court administrators last week. We're trying to do things more efficiently. We know that every dollar from the legislature, from the people of Oregon, because that's who pays this, we understand that, it has to be spent wisely. And we are doing a whole bunch of things internally. I set up, my predecessor, Chief Justice Muniz, set up, and then he made me be the chair of it, a committee called the Court Reengineering and Efficiencies Work Group, which we have made into a permanent part of our management structure. So CREW, Court Reengineering and Efficiencies Work Group. And we have identified a lot of inefficiencies in the system. We're trying to squeeze those out. We now have lots of hearings, not a jury trial. We wouldn't do a jury trial this way, but we do a lot of stuff by video. We do arraignments by video, so you don't have to transport a prisoner from the jail down to the courthouse with the enormous cost of sheriff time and court time to make that happen. If Greg Baxter, our judge in Baker City, settles a case and has some time, he'll get in touch with the judges in LeGrand or Vail and say, you know, I can take some motions for you if you've got a trial going or if you've got a conflict. And he has a video set up in his chambers and in his courtroom. So our judges, particularly in the rural areas where this is really an issue and you may have to drive 200 miles to get to the courthouse, we're now doing more and more of that by video where we can. So we're very proud of those efforts. We've also, Oregon has been a leader in treatment courts, sometimes called specialty courts, mental health, drug treatment, and now we have a veterans court. And these are areas where people have been charged with not the most serious violent offenses. These are often drug crimes or maybe identity theft or other theft crimes. We could put them in jail for several years. If their real problem, though, is that they're alcohol or drug dependent, or they've got PTSD, can't conform themselves now to life in the civilian world, but there are VA services out there that we could help them access, we'll try that. And if they fall off the wagon, we put them in jail right then. That's the thing about treatment court, and another time we could talk about that. But that has been a great success here and some other places in the country.
Douglas County has been kind of a leader in treatment courts, and it has been massively successful. I think it's a great tool for justice. I really do.
Yeah, Senator Cruz, thank you. I appreciate that. And Douglas County has been. They've got some great folks down there. The problem is it costs money.
Yes.
It's a lot faster to take a plea agreement. So, okay, I'm pleading guilty to this identity theft. Okay, we're going to sentence you to 18 months in state prison. And then what happens to that family? And are you really solving the problem? But if you can say, You know, your real problem is you haven't been able to kick that drug habit, and we can get you into a facility, into a program, and you're going to come back to this court every Friday for 18 months, and we're going to see how you're doing. And if you have a bad UA, we're going to put you in jail for the weekend. Those tend to work. But Ed, we've been able to get funding for that. It's, the funding is always a little fragile, but I know that's not your issue.
Well, actually, it should be our issue.
It should be
our
issue.
I've been to a lot of drug court graduations in Douglas County, and the recidivism rate is so low. It's a massive success if we can fund it and operate it properly. It's a great model.
Well, Chair Prozanski, I thought maybe I would pivot just for a minute to the interpretation issue, or I don't know what your schedule is. I know you have other things to do, and I don't want to take up too much of your time.
We've got two bills, and I'm assuming we're going to have two witnesses, one for each. Okay. So I'd say let's go for another 3 to 5 minutes.
Okay. Then let's turn to just a little bit from a session that I did with Justice Landau and Chief Judge Rick Hazelton of the Court of Appeals, and I think some of you were probably there for this, but this was just a little reminder about the way we interpret statutes, because that is, it's so fundamental to what we do. In the old days, courts spent a lot of time on common law issues. You know, the judge made law, and they'd look at the precedents, and we still do that, but probably two-thirds of our cases involve statutory interpretation. In other words, we're trying to implement the statutory policy that the legislature adopted. This all comes from, you know, the constitutional principles that we have. You create the laws, the executive executes them, and we interpret and enforce them. And, of course, the people can make laws, too. Constitutional law and statutory law through the initiative process. And we first try and interpret the statute, but we also have to look at the state constitution, the federal constitution, to determine whether the laws can be enforced as they're applied. So one kind of limitations that the legislature has on its lawmaking authority are procedural ones, and these are in Article 4 of the Constitution. Bills have to be read 3 times, open deliberations, revenue bills need to start in the House, 3/5 majority, one subject, which is in the bill title, and those are pretty straightforward. If there's a close question, we tend to defer to the legislature, but there certainly have been cases where, for example, the legislature passed a funding bill some years ago that included things for mass transit, salmon habitat, and changes in the criminal law. And its subject line was general government. And the Supreme Court threw that out and said, look, you can have broad subjects identified in the title, such as Oregon tax system. But to say general government and to include mass transit and salmon habitat and changes in the criminal law was too much and threw that out. That's a pretty rare case. You're advised by legislative counsel, and that's not much of a problem. And then there are things that constitutional limitations. We have broad provisions on the free exercise of religion and free speech. We have no ex post facto laws. You can't decide, gosh, this conduct somebody engaged in was bad and it should have been criminal. Let's make it criminal now, and then we'll prosecute that person. You can't go back. You can prosecute the next person, but you can't make that law apply retroactively. The role of the courts, determine and enforce the meaning of the Constitution, and we may invalidate, as I said, laws that are passed in violation of procedural or substantive limitations. We don't second-guess your policy choices. We try and implement those. Let's skip this next one. Okay, there are two sets of rules for interpreting statutes. First of all, it's very interesting. I don't know how many other states have this, but Oregon law itself says in Chapter 174, it tells us how to interpret statutes. And it says, for example, you can't add words that are not in the statute, and you can't omit words that are in the statute. It says that if there's a general law and a specific one, the specific one prevails. For example, if there's a general statute that says if you're going to sue someone who caused you harm because of their conduct in a tort case, we would call it, you have to sue within 6 years. But the legislature has changed that for some cases. For example, in sex abuse cases, if you're going to sue somebody who sexually abused you, there are there's a longer statute of limitations. And because that is a more specific enactment, that controls over the more general 6-year provision. Similarly, if there is a later statute that conflicts with an earlier one, we generally say, well, the later statute must express the current legislative intent. And then we have various court-made rules. Really what we try to do, and this is in statute and it's in our case law, we try to do what the legislature intended. But you have to state what you mean in the statute. And that helps us figure out what you did intend. And if the statute doesn't allow that, the words of the statute don't allow that interpretation, we're not going to be able to get there. And if the statute says one thing, and even though Senator Przanski on the floor said, well, it doesn't really mean that. What we really intend to do is this. It's the words of the statute, because it's only the words, this is the theory behind it, that got the 16 or more votes in the Senate and the 31 or more in the House and were signed by the governor. That is what we've got. That's the law. Now, when it's subject to interpretation, we will try to go where the legislature intended, and legislative history helps us there. Some stray comment by a lobbyist doesn't help that much. Everybody has, you know, a reason that they want a bill, but is that really what the legislature intended when they enacted the bill? So statements by committee members, a report, a statement by the person carrying the bill on the floor that everybody, we assume everybody heard, and he said, when we do this, this is what these words mean, is very helpful. The other thing that I think is helpful is providing definitions. Let me give you an example from a case we had the other day. This is not the issue in this case, identity theft. So identity theft is using someone else's name in order to deceive someone for purposes of gain. Now, an interesting question there is, suppose you don't use another actual person's name or identity, but you make something up. You know, I'm Mickey Mouse, M Mouse or Mark Mouse. And that would be an interesting question as to whether somebody else's name, if that's all the statute said, included imaginary people or fictional people. But the legislature, wisely, I think, as a matter of intent, whether it's a good policy or not is not my call, had a definition of person. And the definition of person says real or fictitious. So there, to the courts, it's absolutely clear, using a made-up name, it's not just identity theft, I took your credit card and used it. It's I phonied up a credit card with a made-up name, or I gave a made-up name to the police when they stopped me. That can lead to a possible charge of identity theft. So that's an example of defining a term that might have been up for interpretation by the courts. Now, you can't define every term, and we go ahead and define things using the dictionary, or if the bill involves a legal issue, we'll look at sort of legal technical meanings, or if it involves medical issues, we'll look at the technical medical meanings. But we do, it is best to be clear in legislating. Legislative history doesn't overcome gaps or flaws in the legislative drafting. You have very competent counsel to the committees and legislative counsel to help with this, but you look at a lot of bills, you pass a lot of bills, and we would like to interpret them the way that you intend them to be interpreted, and give us the best help you can, and we will do the best we can to do what the legislature has directed. So, Chair Przanski, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk. I'm happy to take any questions, and informally or formally at another time. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Mr. Ballmer, thank you very much for the presentation.
Any questions? Yep.
Back when I was last on this committee, we were pretty much informed that PGE versus Foley determined the legislative history. And I've understood that that was revised a little bit, because under PGE versus Foley, as I recall, the carrying statement was the most important aspect of legislative history, if the meaning wasn't clear from the plain words.
Right. Senator Burdick, if I may, just to go back a little bit, we had a case called PGE v. Boley, and I think that was a part of it. The most problematic thing about that case, which in that case we said, here's how we're going to interpret statutes. But what we said was, we are not even going to look at the legislative history if the words of the statute are clear enough. And if they aren't, then maybe we'll look at legislative history. And then we did say, Senator Burdick, as you say, here's the type of legislative history that's really important. We're not going to look at this other stuff. We have changed that paradigm. There was a statute, the legislature passed a statute that said, pay more attention to legislative history. We wrote a case called State v. Gaines, and in State v. Gaines, we said, we are willing to look at legislative history at the beginning. We don't have to, and people interpreted PGE v. Boley too strictly, and it was probably not an incorrect interpretation, but the court seemed to say, we're not even going to look, as I said, at legislative history unless the statute is ambiguous. So if we can't find an ambiguity there, you're going to get whatever you wrote. That's not actually wrong, but we are willing to look at legislative history, for example, to show us, no, that's not what they meant at all. The legislative history can show us that the statute was maybe not as artfully drafted as it should have been. We're willing to look at legislative history if it is offered by the parties, and we'll often go and look for it ourselves, as to what the legislature intended when they enacted that law. Now, we still can't get to that intent unless the words of the statute allow us to. If you said this pay increase is intended to apply to these individuals and you said it wrong, well, unless there's something there that shows no, that was absolutely wrong, if the statute says, yes, this applies to all management service personnel, that's the way we're going to interpret it. And yet, if there is legislative history saying, well, the real problem that they were identifying was some people who were not management people, well, you need to say, if you don't want it to apply to the management people, you need to say that. So what we now do, we are now more flexible, is probably the best way to put it, in terms of being willing to look at legislative history. It is true there is better and worse legislative history. I wouldn't say that we would only look at, or the only thing that's important is the statement of the sponsor on the floor. But that, again, that is more impressive to us just because we know everybody heard it. This is the person carrying the bill. They have an understanding of it. It still has to line up with the words in the statute.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the presentation. I'm going to go ahead and close our informational hearing at this point and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 375. Chana, if you can give us an overview.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 375 comes to you from the Oregon Judicial Department. It allows particular court documents to be submitted with a declaration under penalty of perjury or with an affidavit, as is currently the standard. There's no amendment to this measure. We have received all of the paperwork back, and this bill is ready to move.
Thank you. And we have Josh Nasby to give us the overview. Josh?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Josh Nasby, and I'm with the Office of the State Court Administrator in the Oregon Judicial Department. Senate Bill 375 does one thing. It does it in five areas of the law. It authorizes litigants to use what's called a declaration under penalty of perjury instead of an affidavit. What I'd like to do briefly is talk to you a little bit about declarations, describe the five areas of the law that are impacted, and then tell you why we're excited about the bill. So a declaration under penalty of perjury is a statement at the bottom of a document immediately above a signature line that says, I hereby declare that the above statement is true to the best of my knowledge and belief, and that I understand it is made for use as evidence in court and is subject to penalty for perjury. It's the functional equivalent of an affidavit, or for that matter, the oath a court clerk gives to a witness before they testify, with one exception, and that is it can be self-executed. I can sign it by myself without having to visit a notary or have a court clerk swear me in. As the name implies, it's subject to the exact same penalties for lying, if you will, in an affidavit or on the witness stand. A person who lies in with this statement at the bottom of the document can be prosecuted for perjury. So the bill doesn't change the penalties associated with false statements in these documents. At the macro level, the modern trend is to move away from affidavits and towards declarations and court documents. So just about every state in the country has a statute that authorizes the use of a declaration under penalty of perjury in some circumstances. In addition, the federal government and 13 states have really broadly written statutes that say something like, just about any place the law requires you to use an affidavit, you can use a declaration instead. These statutes are subject to a handful of exceptions for things like depositions and the oath of office that you all take, but the general rule in these jurisdictions is that these two documents are interchangeable. Here in Oregon, we've taken a more incremental approach. I'm going to give you a little bit of history real quick. 2003, you amended the Civil Rules of Procedure to allow declarations to be used anytime those rules require an affidavit. 2005, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court followed suit, amended the Uniform Trial Court rules to allow declarations to suffice for an affidavit required under those rules. 2007, you amended the Probate Code to allow declarations there. And more recently, in 2013, you allowed declarations to be used in just about any circumstance if the declarant is physically outside the boundaries of the United States. So Senate Bill 375 is consistent both with this broader trend and the Oregon incremental approach. We've identified five areas of law here, and I'm going to describe those in 1 minute. And what these areas of law have in common are two related things. Number one, it's an area where we see a lot of self-represented litigants, so ordinary Oregonians navigating the court system without a lawyer. And number two, because of that, these are areas of the law where we produce forms that folks can use to provide the court with standardized sort of documents, so the judge has all the information in the right order. And so the five areas of the law are small claims proceedings, so we're talking about civil suits with small dollar amounts involved, written testimony and violation proceedings, so using a common example, if you received a traffic ticket, weren't able to come to court, you can sort of write out an explanation, send it to the court. So the bill amends that area of the law to allow a declaration. The third area is divorce and child custody proceedings. Both the initial petition in a divorce proceeding and there's a lot of motion work in these hearings. So we've amended all of those statutes to allow the declaration as an alternative. And the sort of unifying theme here is all of these documents contain factual assertions. And so the declaration certifies that the declarant certifies through the use of a declaration that everything in there is true. The fourth area is juvenile guardianship reports. So when a person's appointed a guardian under either the Juvenile Code or under ORS Chapter 125, there's a requirement that they submit a report to the court every year describing sort of what's happened in the last year. And as I mentioned earlier, in 2007, you authorized the declaration for the guardianship reports under Chapter 125. So this bill brings the juvenile guardianship reports into the same situation. The last area of the bill affected by the bill involves restraining orders. And so we've amended, the bill amends the Family Abuse Prevention Act, the Elderly Persons and Persons with Disabilities Abuse Prevention Act, and the more recent Sexual Assault Protective Orders to allow the initial petition, the petition for renewal, and the proof of service to be used with the declaration. I think it's important to note that the one area in the restraining order context where the bill leaves the law unamended involves motions to dismiss. So under current law, there's an opportunity for the protected person to come into court and say, I'd like you to dismiss the restraining order. We've retained the affidavit requirement in that context. So again, Senate Bill 375 is focused on these areas of the law because it's where we see self-represented litigants using OJD-developed court forms. And so why do we think this bill is important? On some level, it's a court access issue. Visiting a notary is another burden a litigant must bear, and in some cases, it's an additional expense. But what we're, where we're really excited about this is the transition to eCourt. And as the Chief Justice mentioned earlier, we've developed an interactive question and answer forms, and it's a lot like TurboTax, where you can sort of type in your financial information and it spits out a 1040 that's typewritten and whatnot. The difference being, under Oregon law, because of the affidavit requirement, a litigant's got two options. They can print out the form, go visit a notary, come home, scan it, and then electronically file it. Or they can print out the form and they have to visit the courthouse to file it. And so what Senate Bill 375 will allow us to do is to add a declaration to these forms so that they can be filed in exactly the same way your taxes can be filed electronically. The person can fill out the form, declare that everything in there is true, and hit submit and file the document with the court. And so we think this one-step process, it provides greater access to the courts for court users. And by encouraging these folks to use our electronic filing system, it's going to create efficiencies for the Judicial Department. Thank you.
Josh, thank you very much. Any questions for Josh? So basically, we're just going to allow for easier access to the courts through a process of using declarations versus requiring someone to have an affidavit that requires a second person to be part of that process. If there's no other questions, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 375? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on 375 and open up a work session on 375. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 375 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? Not seeing any, so ordered. And that bill will be carried by Senator Gelser to the floor. Thank you very much. And we'll close.
There'll be lots of questions, by the way.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 375. Now, folks, we're 2 minutes until we're supposed to be shut down. The question is, if you want to stay a couple more minutes, we can probably do the other one, or we can carry it over.
Let's do it.
All right, we'll open up a public hearing at the request of Senator Cruz on Senate Bill 376. And give us a quick overview, and Bruce, if you'll come forward.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, this is OJD's 2015 Court Operations Bill, and it is ready to move.
All right, and Bruce, if you can give us a 30-second spot, that would be great.
Will do. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel to the State Court Administrator. We always bring an efficiencies bill. This is our efficiencies bill. We love the big ones. We love eCourt, but you know what? We got to constantly look for the little ones, and we talk to staff and our customers, and these are the little ones. So sections 1 and 2 deal with post-conviction relief. Those are the actions that take place after a criminal defendant has been convicted, and typically they're based on inadequacy of counsel. So we make two changes there. One, current statute says you got to file a petition and two copies. Guess what? We're in the electronic world. We don't really need those two copies. Section 2 deals with the statute that says you have to attach your evidence. That uses that word, attach. Well, attach has an interesting meaning in the electronic world, and big surprise, we're not all the way into the electronic world yet. Some of our courts are in the paper world, so we don't want to necessarily change that word, but we would like the Chief Justice to be able to enact rules that will deal with those situations so that we can move from our OGIN courts to our Odyssey courts and be able to deal with what does it mean to attach evidence. And then that way the party can refer to the electronic record if they're lucky enough to be in one of those courts without attaching a bunch of paper. Section 3 is a holdover from the days when the courts weren't open all the time. They're open all the time now. We would like to change the statute so that a judge doesn't have to enter an order every year saying we're going to be open every business day, with an exception for the smaller counties where they do actually open and close, and they will continue to issue orders to, so that the public knows when they're open. Section 4, guardianship and juvenile dependency, we want to be able to allow either a declaration under penalty of perjury, the type of thing Josh just discussed, or an affidavit. This tracks what we already do with guardianship reports in the probate code. Sections 5 and 6 deals with the restraining order forms that are in statute for elderly persons and persons with disabilities. We currently have a bunch of these type of things in FAPA and in the sexual abuse arena, and we work with our outside partners to put those forms so that they're consistent and they work well for the parties. And I might point out that OLIS, you have written testimony from Sybil Hebb supporting this. This is something that she works with us on developing the forms. And so it would take those forms out of statute, put it in that group of restraining order forms that we already work on. It's got an emergency clause, so it'll take effect upon passage, and that's what we got.
Thank you. Any questions? Not seeing any. Thank you, Bruce, for your testimony. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 376. Open up a work session on 376.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 376 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 376 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any objections? Not seeing any. So moved. And Senator Thatcher, if you'll be our carrier on 376. We'll close the work session on 376. And we'll close for today, and we're back here tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you very much.
8:30.
Thank you very much. And we're back here tomorrow at 8:30.